Extension number 212811.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, reel 2K stroke 1. If you'd like to read your text.
The military achievements of Field Marshal the Viscount Montgomery of Allemagne were remarkable, and he made an outstanding contribution to victory in World War II. After all the inconclusive fighting in the Western Desert in 1940-41 between Britain and the Empire on the one hand and the German and Italian Axis on the other, which by mid-1942 had brought the latter, led by Field Marshal Rommel, deep into Egypt and within 100 miles of Alexandria and the Nile Delta, it was General Bernard Montgomery, sent out by Churchill to take over the somewhat dispirited and confused Eighth Army, who gave that formation the smack of firm professional leadership by someone who really did know how to manage a major battle and who proved himself every inch a match for the highly professional Germans. General Montgomery, Monty as he became widely known, tore up all the plans to evacuate, if necessary, the Delta in Egypt, which would have given Hitler free access to the Middle East and very likely lost us the war, announcing in a remarkable speech that if they could not stay there at Al Alamein alive, they would stay there dead. He then proceeded to defeat Rommel in a classic defensive battle on the ridge at Alam Halfa, which saved Egypt, and then went on between the 23rd of October and the 1st of November 1942, comprehensively to beat Rommel again in one of the decisive battles of World War II, known simply as Alamein. This was the turning point in the war, as far as Britain was concerned. Before it, as Winston Churchill said, we scarcely had a victory, and after it, virtually never a defeat. This battle precipitated Rommel's long retreat through Libya to Tunisia and led eventually, with the Eighth Army made up of its splendid Australians, New Zealanders, South Africans and Indians, as well as British troops, linking up with the Anglo-American landings from Algiers to complete the total surrender of over 250,000 Germans and Italians in North Africa.
Okay. Carry on.
Monty, by then a charismatic public figure, then went on to lead his victorious Eighth Army in the successful Anglo-American invasion of Sicily, and then across the Straits of Messina, taking them up the east side of Italy as far as the River Sangro, seizing the important airfields at Foggia. Then, at the end of 1943, he was selected for what was probably his finest hour, the masterminding and land command of the whole of the Second Front, British and American, the invasion of Normandy, which, if it had failed, would have put the end of the war back almost indefinitely. In this enterprise, his personal contribution, his self-confidence and his professional leadership was almost the greatest single factor in ensuring total victory in less than 3 months. For what Monty did was to take a planner's plan that would not have worked, convert it into one on a broader front and with a quicker build-up, which would, and also invigorate and give firm direction and grip to a staff which was confused and uncertain. Then, by endless morale-boosting visits to the military and civilian audiences alike, culminating in an epic briefing at St. Paul's School in London, in front of His Majesty the King and the Prime Minister, he convinced everyone, commanders, those taking part, and the country at large, that the Second Front was a feasible operation and was going to be highly successful. Winston Churchill had his doubts, so did the Chiefs of Staff and the Supreme Commander, General Eisenhower. But Monty's self-confidence never faltered. Never faltered, right? Okay.
Okay.
We were going to win, and he inspired all those taking part through what could have been, and indeed for a time was, a close-run thing. And he emphasized that confidence by putting his own headquarters ashore on D+2, in close proximity to the front line and under direct shellfire, and in front of many of his subordinate commanders. It was leadership of the highest quality. After the successful outcome of the Normandy campaign, when the Falaise pocket was virtually closed with vast German losses in both men and material, the Allied forces were lined up on the River Seine 3 months after the initial landing, and exactly as Monty had predicted. The Battle of Normandy did not go in terms of timing exactly according to plan, and German resistance had been very powerful and fanatical. But Montgomery's overall design for battle of drawing the bulk of the German forces onto the eastern, that is to say, the British flank of the bridgehead, and allowing the whole battle line to pivot on that point, with the Americans breaking out to the west and sweeping round behind the Germans, was in fact overall generally maintained.
Okay.
The Germans having been defeated in Normandy, Montgomery then led his British 21st Army Group, having handed over the command of the Allied land forces to General Eisenhower, with only one setback at Armelin, a bridge too far, through the Low Countries, capturing Brussels and Antwerp, across the Rhine, and ultimately over the North German plain to the Elbe and the Baltic, taking the surrender of all German forces in the north at Lüneburg Heath. At the end of the war, he became chief of the Imperial General Staff, and then a truly international figure, first as chairman of the Western Union Chiefs of Staff, and then, when NATO was formed in 1949, as Deputy Supreme Allied Commander. Thus, he became a major influence in shaping Western strategy to confront the Soviet Union during the Cold War and to deter any dangerous escalation in that confrontation. So, in both war and peace, Montgomery was a figure and personality of world renown and was almost certainly Britain's greatest professional soldier since Wellington.
Early in your remarks, you referred to Montgomery as being a professional in his approach to the military art. What are the characteristics of the professional?
I think this is what really marked him out from so many of his contemporaries at that time. He really studied his profession from A to Z. He understood the interrelationship between all arms. And to put it very generally, he knew how to manage a battlefield. He knew how to give a design for battle, a master plan, to decentralize the handling of that plan, and to keep his mind free for what would come next in order to exploit the particular battle at the time or to deal with some enemy reaction. I think he was every inch a professional. The Germans had a great many of them. The British Army at that time had a lot of brave soldiers, but they perhaps were not as professional. Montgomery brought this intense professionalism to the job, and that's what marked him out.
What do you think it was that had made him so professional in his approach? Was it his earlier experience during the First World War and the period between the wars, or something inherent in his character?
I'm sure his experiences in the First World War had something to do with it. I mean, he was determined that the awful slaughter of the trenches and the Somme and the various battles at Ypres would not be repeated. I mean, you can't win battles without having casualties, and there were a number of casualties at Alamein, but he always did his best to make sure his soldiers had the wherewithal to do the job, and he kept the casualties down to the minimum. The other thing was that he did not have a great many other outside interests. He wasn't actually a bad sportsman. I think he played cricket for his school and so on like that. But he hadn't joined the army merely to take part in sport and do things like that. He had joined the army to make himself an intense professional. And he was completely dedicated, and particularly after his wife died, he really gave his whole life to his soldiering and had no sort of impedimenta, so to speak, family impedimenta. And he had a very nice and now become very distinguished son, David Montgomery. But he rather left him in the care of others, and he concentrated on the job in hand.
You were saying that you thought his achievements in Northwest Europe were his greatest and outshone his achievements in the Mediterranean theatre. But could one not argue that in the Mediterranean theatre he had fewer resources and he was further away from home and he was facing a more difficult situation on arrival compared to the circumstances in which he launched Operation Neptune Overlord?
Well, I'm not writing down his achievements in the desert. I mean, I thought the first battle he ever fought at Alam Halfa, before Alamein itself, was an absolute masterpiece of an army commander controlling the whole battle from start to finish. And there was no doubt that Alamein was decisive, and it was fought in a way that really separated Rommel's armour from his infantry and didn't try an easy way of just trying to get round the flank. It took him on head on. But you do have to remember that by Alamein, Monty did have the equipment. He outnumbered the Germans in tanks, and the army by that time really were prepared, which they hadn't been before, and they had new tanks from America. I'm not writing those down. Of course, in Italy, the 8th Army up the east side of Italy got rather bogged down like everybody else. But I think that the thing about the Second Front was that it really was one of the decisive battles. If it had failed, and after all the Germans had internal lines of communication, and they knew that the war was lost if they allowed it this to succeed, so of course they put every effort into dealing with it. The fact that he came and said, this plan won't work, I will produce a plan that does work, and that he put this confidence across to a lot of people who had quite serious doubts about whether it would come off or not. I think his leadership there and his professional there really made all the difference. And that is why I rather rate that as his finest hour.
As a partial reprise, you've emphasized his skill in maintaining and raising morale and creating confidence at all levels, from the ordinary soldier to the statesman in the war cabinet. But when he arrived in the Mediterranean theatre, the 8th Army had been defeated, it had retired, there was demoralisation, and he had to create a sense of resolution in defence and then the confidence to go forward and launch the major offensive of Alamein. One might argue that when he came to Britain in 1944, the troops whom he commanded then had been so well trained and intensively rehearsed that they were raring to go, that he didn't have to conduct the same sort of morale raising function as he had when he arrived to command 8th Army.
Well, I think he did. You're quite right. Of course, it was a remarkable achievement in the desert, because he came out with everyone rather suspicious of him. Here was this new general, another general who was much beloved by the 8th Army, called General Strafer Gott, had actually been appointed and had been killed on his way back to Cairo, shot down on his way back to Cairo. And this new general, nobody knew all that about him. His knees weren't very brown. He was obviously rather full of himself. And to begin with, there was a great deal of suspicion. But he did very quickly get them on the side by the clarity of his mind, his determination, and the way he could put things across in the simplest forms that everybody understood. I take your point about armies in waiting in England, but of course not all of them had seen battle by any means. Most of the Americans had not, and a lot of the British forces. He did, of course, insist on having a balance. He brought back some of the old formations, like the 7th Armoured Division, particularly the 51st Highland Division and so on, to give experience. But this was the first time that a landing on this scale had been done. And after all, the last one that had been done on the north coast of Europe at Dieppe had been an utter miserable failure. And so people would otherwise have been very considerably apprehensive. And the Germans, of course, under Rommel now, he commanded the army group, under very experienced commanders, with a great many SS fanatical formations available, you know, the thing had got to be got right. And he did convince them, and I, of course, took part in this landing, and I remember well being briefed by Montgomery and gathering round him, and we went away with the feeling, this man knows what he's talking about. He wouldn't be putting us into battle unless he got the plan right, and so on. And it made an enormous difference. And, of course, he didn't only, as you've just said, he didn't only do it to the troops, he did it to the politicians, and he did it to the people in the war factories who had to produce all the ammunition, etc. He did it to the whole nation.
Some critics of the Field Marshal have said that he was politically rather tactless. In particular, he had some difficult passages of arms with his allies, with General Eisenhower, with General Patton, and with ultimately with General Bradley as well, and that he lacked tact, and that he was not as effective as an army group commander as Field Marshal Alexander in Italy, who had a diverse allied force to command and managed things rather more smoothly. What would you say to that?
Yes, I would agree. I think he did lack tact. There's no doubt about it. And I think that he did make two mistakes in Normandy. Not to begin with, but first of all, he always insisted, and of course you had to bear in mind that what he said got out in the press and got round to the troops. He first of all insisted that everything was going exactly according to plan, when quite clearly, as a result of very intense German resistance, it was not always going exactly to plan. It was within the overall Montgomery design for battle, and it ended up, of course, exactly corresponding with his timings on the stage. But in between, a lot of things didn't go right, particularly the seizing of the airfields, which the Royal Air Force and the American Air Force had been promised, but particularly the Royal Air Force, southeast of Caen, on the way to Falaise. I mean, that did not go according to plan. But he kept on insisting that everything was going exactly according to plan, and that rather annoyed the people above him. And secondly, he was very tactless with the Americans, and I think behaved at some stages very badly to Eisenhower. I mean, he did always take this view that Eisenhower was a purely a coordinator. He'd never been in battle, he didn't understand battles. Monty was the man who understood battles and so on. And so he got across, whether he actually had or not, he got across a certain sort of contempt for his allies, because he always thought he could do it much better. And later on, after the Normandy battle, of course, he had this rather stupid row about trying to insist that all the resources went to him and were taken away from people like Patton and Bradley further south. Even if this had been the right tactical answer, and of course you can argue, tacticians can argue, even if it had been the right, it was absolutely, practically impossible for Eisenhower to stop pattern in his tracks and give everything to Montgomery. I think he was a bit tactless, and he was bailed out a number of times by his marvelous chief of staff, General de Gangon, who tried to put oil on troubled waters. But, of course, that didn't detract from his professionalism. It just meant that he wasn't really a political general.
Would you say he had an almost purely military mentality?
I think he saw things in pretty stark military terms. That is why I do not think he was a particularly successful chief of the Imperial General Staff, because he saw the whole situation in Whitehall as a sort of military campaign. You want to do this? Right, that's what we'll do. Well, of course, any of us who've been in Whitehall knows that it's much more complicated than that. And he really couldn't adapt and adjust himself, I think, to the sort of interplay of all the pressures in Whitehall. And he wasn't a particularly successful chief of the Imperial General Staff. I think that when he went off to shape, he didn't have any sort of direct command responsibilities, but he was a very useful man for lecturing on tactics and going visiting world leaders and so on. He was at his best in the field. And you might say, well, doesn't that mean an army commander his limit? But, of course, the army group and the invasion of Normandy was very much a frontline force. I mean, with a bridgehead only a few miles deep, the army group was having the sort of control that an army commander or even a corps commander would have under normal circumstances.
When he went off on his unofficial or semi-official informal ambassadorial visits to the Vatican and to various other foreign powers, he does seem to have got on quite well with the leaders in those places.
Oh, he always used to boast, you know, that all the great world leaders, the Pope, Mao Zedong, and anyone you care to mention, really, were great personal friends of his. And I think the Foreign Office kept a fairly close eye on him and wondered what he was saying and what he was committing the country to. But he was, in many ways, a good ambassador, quite a good ambassador.
Do you think that perhaps he was capable of learning from his political mistakes and developing a more diplomatic approach?
Yes, I think he was capable of learning. I think when he first went to Whitehall, people don't always know this, he wasn't the original choice to be a chief of the Imperial General Staff. Field Marshal Alexander was. But Allenbrooke stayed on part of the Potsdam Conference. He stayed on longer than was expected. And by the time the post became vacant, Field Marshal Alexander had been asked for to be Governor General of Canada and had gone off there, and so Monty stepped into the breach. But, I mean, he just thought that Whitehall was inefficient, and he couldn't quite see why he couldn't use exactly the same principles and clear-cut solutions that he'd used when he was commanding an army.
Of course, he did have the great advantage of having been a great and successful commander at army group level in the field before he went to Whitehall. Perhaps that might have made him a little arrogant in his...
Well, he was a man then of course considerable stature, and he was always said to get on very well with the first Secretary of State for War, Minister of War, Emanuel Shinwell. They got on very well together, but he did not get on well with his other chiefs of staff, of course, who quite frankly disliked him. And he had not very much time for them. He'd already clashed swords with the Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Lord Tedder, when Lord Tedder was at Shape and Eisenhower's deputy. And they had got annoyed about Montgomery always saying everything was going according to plan. And he didn't get on with the other Cunningham. That wasn't A.B. Cunningham, who'd done so well in the Mediterranean. It was... John Cunningham, who was First Sea Lord. And as a result, Montgomery tended to not attend Chiefs of Staff meetings, but send his vice chief.
How had things changed in regard to the organisation of higher command when you were field marshal and you were serving at the highest level? What had the political changes been?
Well, of course, since the war, when I think the... we were talking earlier about professionalism. I think the British Army has been incredibly professional, and I don't think it's put many feet wrong, if any, since the war. But, of course, most of the operations that the British Army have fought since 1945 have been on a very much smaller scale. Korea, I suppose, was a proper conventional war, but it certainly wasn't on the scale of Northwest Europe in 1944-45. And the Gulf War, of course, only lasted for a very short time. So most of it had been on a much smaller scale, and there have been a lot of other factors apart from military factors. But, of course, we were all preparing during that time. I was a divisional commander in this thing. We were preparing, of course, to fight a full-scale war, should, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union decide to use their military force for seizing parts of Western Europe. And under those circumstances, of course, we would have had to have fought a battle which would needed to be controlled, but of course it would have been a NATO battle with a lot of nations involved, political decisions being taken. It would have been a much more complicated affair. And one has seen that recently in Kosovo, where one has had to have got agreement of the nations before anything could happen. Montgomery's chain of command was very, very much simpler. And the combined chiefs of staff were in the ascendancy, and Montgomery reported to Eisenhower, he reported to the combined chiefs of staff, and it was a much less complicated business with much less political content than there would be if one had any operations today.
But when you were in control at the time of the Falklands War, would you say that you had to be more politically aware than Montgomery had been?
Well, the Falklands, interestingly, was a pretty clear-cut operation. First of all, no other countries were involved except ourselves, although Americans did give some useful assistance, but no other countries were involved. We had a prime minister who took to war leadership like a duck to water and was therefore very crisp about running a war cabinet. And in actual fact, the Falklands campaign, unlike many since, worked not unlike some of the campaigns in the Second World War. I mean, there was a very clear line from the war cabinet through the chiefs of staff, to the commander-in-chief, down to the task force commander. And decisions were taken very rapidly, and that really did have quite an affinity with the way that some of the campaigns were conducted in the Second World War.
Had there been any changes in military technology which transformed the role of the senior commander between the time when Montgomery was commanding and when you were effectively commanding?
Well, I think, of course, the most fantastic change in technology has been the whole question of aerial bombardment. I think I should point out that if Montgomery's leadership was one of the main factors for our success, winning the air battle was certainly the second one. And that was done by a mixture of the air superiority that the Royal Air Force and the American Air Forces had achieved by bombing over Germany, and certainly in the cases of the daylight bombing of the Americans, forcing the Luftwaffe up to deal with them and then shooting them down with these long-range fighters, the Mustang and the Thunderbolt. And there's no doubt that the ground forces could not have achieved what they did in the bridgehead if it hadn't had the air superiority that the air forces had won. But when the air forces, when the ground forces ever got stuck in a battle, the feeling then was to bring in the heavy bombers to bomb them down the Falaise Road or Intercom, whatever it was. And of course, this was a very double-edged weapon and probably was almost counterproductive because, of course, it destroyed.